May it please the court, I'm Michael Marabella. I represent Ms. Gendron, the defendant and appellant. If I could summarize the appellant's position on the issues before the court in a few simple words, would be the old sports bromide that you're just not allowed to pile on, even in a default, even if you don't know if the defendant has been served. The trial court has a duty to make sure that there's been procedural due process as well as substantive due process. To see that minimum levels of fairness are afforded to the parties before entering a large civil judgment. The same level of basic fairness applies both on the issue of jurisdiction, whether or not service was made, and on the issue of the size of the judgment and the support for that judgment. The facts are fairly simple in this case, and if the court doesn't have any questions of me about the procedural history or the facts, I'd like to just go directly to the issue of the judgment. The court's failure to meet basic due diligence in arriving at the amount of the judgment requires reversal of at least part, if not all, of the judgment. The court improperly awarded unliquidated damages based solely on the plaintiff's unsupported affidavit stating an amount of what the damages were worth without telling the court what the injury was.
Mr. Mirabella, what's our standard of review on this issue?
The standard of review is abuse of discretion, Your Honor.
Well, there's some discussion in the briefs about whether or not you raised this issue in the trial court and therefore whether the plain error standard of review applies. Yes. So I'm wondering whether it seemed like in your reply brief you were agreeing that with the appellee that that was the standard.
I believe that it is an abuse of discretion standard. However, this case, the record supporting the damages is so sparse that I think even applying abuse of discretion, the plain error rule gets us to this issue, even though it wasn't briefed below. The plain error portion of our response went to the fact that we didn't brief this below. The reason it wasn't briefed below was nobody ever looked at the record until we received the record. We were focused solely on the issue of service of process. So when we looked at the record and saw, oh, wait a minute, there's no medical records attached to the motion for default judgment. There's no medical bills attached to the motion for default judgment. There's no statement in the affidavit of what the costs were. There's no statement in the affidavit about property damage whatsoever. And so even on a portion of the damages that are supposedly liquidated that should be able to be calculated subject to mathematical precision, there's nothing to do mathematical precision on because the court didn't have those documents in front of them.
Mr. Mirabella, if we conclude that there was proper service, why couldn't we also conclude that the damages issue is not reversible given that it doesn't exceed the statutory caps in Colorado?
I didn't really consider the cap issue, Your Honor. The problem is that it's not supported by evidence. The unliquidated damages have to be supported by testimony.
Wasn't there an affidavit from Mrs. Herrera?
You need live testimony. An affidavit isn't sufficient. And I think I can give you an example out of the real world. Unfortunately, there's a commercial right now from our colleague, Mr. Mateer, where the person talks about how it was like a machete. Every time they use their hand, it's a machete slicing their hand, and then she holds up a finger that's got a Band-Aid on it and says, somebody has to pay. And the point of the commercial from Mr. Mateer is that, well, you have to have a real injury. I don't know what this lady's injury is. The injury, the affidavit doesn't say what the injury is. It just says, I had $12,000 in medical expenses, which aren't supported by by invoices showing what those were, and I've got pain and suffering into the future. It, for all I know, it could be that finger with a Band-Aid on it. We just don't know. The court has a duty before it puts a $200,000 judgment with interest at this point on a fairly fairly impecunious person who has some insurance, but not very much. We've got a $200,000 judgment that she's not going to be able to fight about. We don't even know what the damage is, what the injury is. And the court doesn't either. That's the problem.
If your client had been properly served,
yes, sir,
wouldn't the judge have been overstepping his or her bounds by taking an advocatory role, by saying, no, you have to have evidence presented in a certain form before I'll consider it to be sufficient?
If he's taking an advocatory role, yes.
Wouldn't he have taken an advocatory role by saying to the other side, no, I won't accept anything until you have it in the way in which, if the party were here, the party could insist on having?
That's not exactly what I'm saying they had to do, Your Honor. What I'm saying he has to do is just meet a basic threshold of confirming that there's a damage and that the damage is worth a particular amount. And that's why in the sorry, I got my citation. That was the court's point, I believe, in the Johnson versus Devaney case, where they said, you know, the judge doesn't play an advocatory role, but the court is like a gatekeeper. It has to make sure that there's a minimum level of sufficient evidence to support that.
Has that been a default case as well?
Yes, that was a default case as well, Your Honor. In that case, the defendant had been somewhat involved in the case prior to the default entering, and the trial court wouldn't let them participate in the default hearing. And the Court of Appeals sent it back and said, now the default was correct. We agree that the defendant was properly served, and they didn't respond due to their own carelessness, but we can't allow piling on. We can't allow the judgment to stand because it's so extreme without any possibility of anyone taking the defendant's side on it to see what would be the proper amount of damages. I think, frankly, you know, Ms. Herrera was probably injured in the accident and does deserve some compensation. What that is, given the state of the record, is impossible to determine, even with regard to the liquidated damages, because there's no support for the liquidated damages outside of the affidavit of the plaintiff. And frankly, I don't think the plaintiff personally has a lot of knowledge of those things. I think that's probably from her counsel. If I may, on the issue of the propriety of service, I think that case is also very clear. Worth versus Heritage International requires the court to hold a hearing when there's conflicting affidavits, which is what we have here, to determine which affidavits are credible. There's really no way for the court right now, the trial court, to determine whether or not service was made. He might have an inkling one way or another. He might have some thought about it, but until he receives testimony and reviews, and frankly, until I get a chance to cross-examine the process server and the telephone clerk from the Azar firm that are supporting the idea that service was made, I'm not sure how the court comes to that conclusion.
So why isn't that affidavit from the paralegal, which apparently was substantiated with her contemporaneous notes, attesting to that June 2010 phone call from from Mrs. Gendron. Why isn't that, sufficient circumstantial evidence of service? It came after the lawsuit was filed, and, you know, there's this contemporaneous note that also substantiates it.
Because no one's had an opportunity to cross-examine that clerk to find out the details of that call, to explore whether or not that was actually a contemporaneous note or one that was written later, to do all the sorts of things that you'd have in a contested hearing. That's why you have a contested hearing. The paperwork itself is not, and why isn't, the same question kind of goes back. Why doesn't Mrs. Gendron's affidavit that says, no, I didn't call the clerk and I never talked to anybody at the Azar office, why isn't that show that that didn't happen? Now, we've got conflicting affidavits. The court has to sort through the testimony. The court with live testimony is in the best position to determine those issues. I'm going to reserve the remainder of my time unless you have any further questions on those two issues. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Robert Fischel, and along with my associate Keith Scranton, I'm the attorney for Marcelo Herrera. To some extent, Your Honors, I've got to wonder why we're even here. I think that we've got a defendant who causes an accident, flees the scene, tries to avoid process. They file a late notice of appeal, and that's really where we are. I mean, it's late every time we turn around. It's late. That notice of appeal was late, and this court granted an extension based on excusable neglect of Mr. Mirabella. I understand that. But there are two attorneys, two different law firms in this instance. Mr. Kavanaugh was actually the first attorney representing Ms. Gendron. He's still on the file. He's in this courtroom today. He actually signed the briefs. There is no evidence before this court of excusable neglect. Looking at it from the perspective of a plaintiff's lawyer, if I was a co-counsel with another attorney representing a plaintiff and we blew a statute of limitations and I told the other attorney, I'm going to file the lawsuit and I don't do it, you can bet that the plaintiff is going to be suing both me and the other attorney. They've got the same obligation to this court to display excusable neglect, both of them. And the failure of Mr. Kavanaugh to do so, I believe, deprives this court of jurisdiction. The notice of appeal was late and this court shouldn't hear it.
If we find that there is excusable neglect, can you tell us why, you know, the fact that there are these conflicting affidavits, one saying service, one saying no service, why doesn't that create, you know, something akin to a genuine issue of material fact, such that the trial court has to hold a hearing, has to hear from both sides, and has to make credibility determinations?
Well, I think that the court can make credibility determinations without
on paper.
I'm sorry?
Based on paper?
Yes, Judge Fox. I think the judge can. I mean, there's and very different from the Worth case, in my opinion. If we look at the Worth case, the supposed managing director named Bridge was served as well. He was served individually as well as on behalf of this Heritage International Holdings. And the plaintiff got a default against both of them. So there's something interesting or problematic perhaps going on in that particular case. Why didn't Bridge answer for himself if he got served properly? The trial court did not allow the defendant in the Worth case to file any kind of response whatsoever. Nothing. Within a very short period of time, nothing was done.
Mr. Fischel, in the Worth case, though, didn't Judge Criswell use more expansive language to indicate that when there are conflicting affidavits, a court must hold a hearing to resolve the conflicts?
I do read that, and trying to get around that, and I noticed Judge Talman that you were part of that panel as well, and so I think that Judge Criswell did, in fact, and certainly did say that under 60B3 that he felt that a hearing was appropriate, but I believe it's limited to the facts and worth. And if the court were also in that holding, Judge Criswell notes that the Supreme Court has not, in fact, required a hearing under 60B at all, and did not, and I think it was in what side of the Fleischer case, and that the Supreme Court did not reach whether or not an evidentiary hearing is necessary. So I think that each case turns on its facts. And on this one, there was significant amount of affidavits involved that I don't think it was incumbent upon the court to hold a hearing in this case.
But to follow up on Judge Fox's question, like just as in a summary judgment case where there are maybe conflicting affidavits, how can district court judge resolve the differences in those affidavits based on the affidavits alone?
I guess in some respect, the way Judge Speer did, he looked at them, he weighed the evidence on what he saw. I don't think that it's something that is absolutely positively required in every instance. And in this one, there was a significant amount of written evidence, if you will, the various affidavits, that I think Judge, not knowing what Judge Speer thought, but I think that he certainly could, in fact, determine that based on the affidavits without holding a hearing.
Isn't demeanor an important part of assessing credibility?
I think to some extent, yes, sir, it is.
To some extent?
To some extent. I mean, you know, you can get some people up there and they can lie with a straight face and you just don't know. And I think that, you know, one of the things that's very difficult too, Judge Daly, with this particular one is if we had a hearing would have been held a year after the data service. Now, my paralegal, who still works for me, you know, has some basic recollection, but what was recorded in that note, that's the full substance of the phone call. It was basically, I took a phone call, she identified herself as Ms. Gingram, and actually it's a note that's attached to the file that was sent to me. So I was aware of it immediately. And so, you know, what good is that going to do you? She's going to get on the stand and for 1 minute she's going to say exactly what she said in the affidavit. I told her to call Rio National, I gave her the number, and that was it. The process server, basically, it's in his entire affidavit. If you read his affidavit, it's not just I served her by refusal. He talks about getting there at 6:45. He talks about waiting for a long period of time, and she identified herself as Ms. Gendron. He didn't have a great look at her. He dropped stuff off, and that's his affidavit. What else is he going to be able to do? I mean, the only one whose demeanor maybe might be able to be judged would be Ms. Gendron's. And you know, I had a lot of questions there, but she comes out with a second affidavit, suddenly remembering that on May the 18th, she specifically remembered she wasn't at home all day. And she could have done that the first time. Which also brings me to the second point is, I don't believe that they've actually properly preserved. I don't believe that the motion for reconsideration is actually a Rule 59 motion, such as a motion for new trial. I certainly believe that, because all they did was regurgitate their motion to quash and motion to vacate. Same thing. And I believe, therefore, that the time to file a notice of appeal actually began to run when the denial of the first motion to quash and motion to vacate was rendered, and I believe that was on March the 15th. I may be incorrect on the exact date.
Mr. Fischel, is there some authority that says that you have to have completely different information in a motion for reconsideration from your original motion to count as a valid motion?
I don't believe I have any authority specific on that point, but in our brief, I think that, and a lot of it are criminal cases, but it's basically saying if you're regurgitating the same thing, it does not toll the running of time to file your notice of appeal. And I'd have to refer you to the brief, Judge Stallman. So therefore, you know, another reason why I think that we're late again, and their notice of appeal is bad. I also want to point out that their argument over the failure for the court to hold a hearing on default judgment is waived, one, because it's not in the notice of appeal at all. Secondly, there's no requirement under Rule 55 to even have a hearing, none whatsoever. And if the court will look through the record, the court will see that the trial judge did not grant a default judgment for my client the first time we filed a motion, required supplemental information, didn't do it the second time, and waited until the third time before I finally gave the court the information that he required under Rule 121, I think it's Section 1-14, if I remember right, there's specific requirements which were fully complied with. And as a result, a hearing's not necessary. And, of course, there's a strict reading of the rule under Rule 55, so the court may hold a hearing. It's not necessary at all. The only cases that the defendant has cited about having a hearing set, every one of those cases, the defendant in some form or fashion had appeared in the court, whether it's the Quickway case, whether it's the Johnson versus Devaney case, any of those cases, the defendant was at least a part of the case, had appeared, either filed some kind of notice of appearance, had in some form or fashion filed something with the court so that they were a part of the action. And in each case, each one of those cases, the court then said a hearing should have been held and notice, a proper notice. And I believe one of the cases, it may have been Quickway, it was all they did was just give the defendant a three-day notice. That's all that's required. But there's no, I'm sorry.
Mr. Frischel, I have two questions. One is, you said that you thought raising the issue about the amount of damages was inappropriate because it wasn't raised in the notice of appeal. My understanding is that the issues stated in the notice of appeal are purely advisory. Do you have some authority that states differently?
I don't. I can do something supplemental on that to see, but I believe that to be the case if it's not raised in the notice of appeal.
Okay, and then the second question that I wanted to ask is about the standard of review, which I asked Mr. Mirabella, and you pointed out in your brief that it hadn't been raised in the district court, and therefore plain error review is appropriate. And in light of the contentions by Mr. Mirabella that the damages weren't properly supported, what is your view about the applicability of the plain error standard and how it should be applied here?
I think that the standard, I honestly, Judge Taubman, I'd have to school myself a little bit better on the plain error review as opposed to abuse of discretion. So to answer the question, again, I'd have to take a look and see, perhaps give you something supplemental on that. But, I think that one of the things that Judge Daly said was, is that if the court does anything other than, if you will, make us meet the requirements of 121 and Section 1-14, then the judge becomes an advocate for the defendant. And the information provided within the affidavit by Ms. Gendron, by myself, met those requirements, as well as the affidavit by the process server, met those requirements to satisfy default judgment. And the court could do nothing other than what he did. He could have held a hearing. It wouldn't have been any different other than perhaps taking some evidence. But it's not required other than the evidence that was given to him in the affidavits. One of the other things I think is at least in this court has to take notice of is that the defendant has said, and several times in its brief, in the motion that it filed with the court, is that if I had just notified the insurance company that we had served the defendant, we wouldn't even be here today. And I take a little bit of exception to the notice of appeal and in the brief, because the defendant is in essence accusing me of a falsehood. 2 months after the default judgment, I caused the default judgment and the complaint and the order to be faxed to the insurance company. And they're trying to say that they didn't have notice for 6 months, basically saying I was trying to hide behind the law. I did no such thing. In fact, I did above and beyond anything that's required of me in a good faith effort to give them an opportunity to respond within the 6 month time period that Rule 60 allows them. I faxed them a copy of the judgment to the same fax number that I faxed them the judgment 6 months later. And we didn't do anything about it. They waited. Why? I don't know. They have notice. They're late. They've been late for everything since the suit was filed. They didn't file an answer. They didn't file any type of response under Rule 60. And they're late on the notice of appeal. Everything is late. And the defendant is now trying to convince this court that woe is me, we're piling on. We didn't do any piling on. I didn't do anything. We didn't do anything that wasn't required of me by the law. And the court didn't do anything that wasn't required of him. The court did not have to hold a hearing, not at the Rule 55 default judgment motion and judgment, and the court is not required, I believe, under these circumstances, with all the facts that they have before, that he had before him, by affidavit form, I don't believe that a hearing was absolutely required. Again, as the court has pointed out, and as this court pointed out in Worth, the Supreme Court's not addressed that and has not made a requirement under Rule 60B that a hearing is held. And therefore, there is no error by the trial court in granting the default, and which, I believe they didn't preserve their error, and there's no error in the court denying the motion to quash, denying the motion to vacate, and in essence, upholding the default judgment that was rendered in July of 2010. Any questions? Otherwise, I'm prepared to sit down. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very briefly, Your Honors, I would explain my co-counsel Kevin's excusable neglect by the fact that he was not involved. His name appears on it. If you look at the record, you'll see that he did not sign it. He did not sign the notice of appeal. He did not sign the briefs. Actually, I put him on just in case I was going to need him later. Once the motion to reconsider was denied, the case landed in my lap, and he simply was not involved. If there's any neglect, excusable or not, it's on my shoulders, not on Kevin's. Counsel pointed out how good the affidavit of the process server was. However, the affidavit of the process server says that Ms. Gendron weighs 200 pounds, is 5'9", and does not wear glasses. Ms. Gendron is at most, and she might get mad at me if I say this, she might be 150. She's about 5'4", and wears glasses, and they're fairly thick glasses. She wears them all the time. There's lots of reasons to question whether or not the service was made. On the issue of whether or not Rule 59 stops the clock, the case that I cited in my brief, which is eluding me right now, makes it clear that a Rule 59 motion following a Rule 60 motion stops the clock. It wasn't a regurgitation of our previous motion. It brought to bear new facts that Ms. Gendron was receiving medical treatment that day and was at her aunt's house that day, and that her husband was at work that day, and that there were no other adults living in that home. The reason it was different is that the judge specifically ruled that he didn't know who was served, but that an adult at the defendant's home had been served. That's what the ruling on the Rule 60 motion says. And then the Rule 59 motion said, no, Your Honor, there isn't another adult there. There was no adult there that day. So it's a new issue, not a regurgitation. Unless the court has any other questions about my response to counsel, I would add that Mr. Fischel shouldn't feel too bad about not fully understanding the differences between plain error and abuse of discretion. To me, I think we meet either, but I'm similarly confused by that issue.
Thank you. Thank both counsel for their fine arguments. The case is deemed submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. Thank you both.